I suppose my slightly competitive nature, and it only comes out here really, is that I want to try and be ahead of the game. And it's interesting to synthesize ideas into something which might be seen to be new or taken from a different angle. And that's fun.
Presented by Arcata, the anti-fraud and customer due diligence network for the art world, The Bigger Picture presents a special series of episodes in partnership with London Art Week. A showcase of the best the art market has to offer, we take an inside look at the galleries participating and the stories behind the people that shape them. Picture specialist at a major auction house, managing director of one of London's most significant old master dealerships, numerous important previously undiscovered works by John Constable, Joseph Wright, and a groundbreaking exhibition of British landscapes by Gainsborough, are a selection of some of the highlights of Lowell Libson's art dealing career spanning more than 40 years. Today, a trustee of Gainsborough House and director of Libson & Yarker with his business partner Johnny, Lowell recounts his formative years while offering a highly personal and unique perspective into his passion for British art. So take us back to the beginning when you were 9 or 10. What were you buying and selling, and how does your grandmother fit into all this?
Well, I was a sad child, probably. I was always interested in objects and art, and I started buying the odd print with my pocket money, I suppose at the age of 10 or so, and I never thought about selling them, though I have to say, occasionally, I was able to, that's an enormous profit, no brilliance of mine, just timing and luck. It amused me. I once bought some prints in a sort of so-called gallery. It was a junk shop just off the high street where we lived, and kept them for a couple of years. And then another junk shop opened around the corner, and I took them in, and they bought them from me at about sort of five times what I'd paid for them. That amused me, but it didn't spur me on to becoming an art dealer. You asked about my grandmother. She was a great hunter, frequenter of auctions, and she liked buying things. She liked nice things, and I at home I was brought up with some of the things that she'd passed on to my mother, and it just gave me a taste for looking at these things. Never particularly conscious.
So you just developed an interest by virtue of being attracted to them for what they were, essentially.
Yes, and then sort of later on, I became particularly interested in history, and I was always very interested in and have been, and still are, you know, the context of objects and how they fit in to the time and the society in which they were produced.
Yeah, that actually leads me on to my next note here, actually, because my thought was it the research side, the buying or the selling, or the meeting people that you would say you enjoyed most?
Well, it's always been the thrill of the chase. I mean, it's a fairly basic sort of human reaction to things out there. I suppose early on it was a sort of a relatively solitary pastime, and you know, one could use one's own imagination on things without them sort of, as it were, interfering with one. So. That sounds slightly sort of flippant, but I've always actually liked objects and related to them.
So, despite these early signs that a career in art looked quite likely, you didn't know what to do when you left school, and you thought about career in the wine trade. However, there's a particularly important date that follows: the 12th of January, 1975. It was here you had found a world where you felt you did belong. What happened, and what stands out in your mind as the reason you felt such a strong sense of place?
Well, after leaving school, I drifted around not knowing quite what I wanted to do or could do, for that matter. And I had at one stage a crazy idea of going into the wine trade, and I wanted to learn the craft on a vineyard. I'm actually quite dyslexic, and I got a very, very poor grasp of languages, so it didn't occur to me that not having French would be any deterrent to working on a vineyard in France. And I plugged away at that, trying to get something, and an old friend from primary school, who was at that stage a porter at Phillips the Auctioneers, suggested that I got a part-time job there whilst I was waiting for something to turn up. And I went off to have an interview with the general manager, very amiable man called Donald Baker, who said, nothing doing. I realise you're interested in pictures, and we'll let you know. And I assumed my letter went straight into the bin thereafter. About a month later, I had a call from him saying, well, actually, there's a vacancy as a porter in the paintings department. Would you like it? The pay is $17.50, and I didn't know whether that was $17.50 a year or $17.50 a week. I mean, not great at the difference. And I turned up on the first day, which was the 12th of January 1975, and I walked in and I thought, actually, here's something that I can actually do which I like. And I never looked back, for better or worse.
You do, however, what's quite interesting, you go quite quickly from being a porter to a picture specialist. How do you think it became clear to management there that you were in possession of quite unusual and in their eyes, valuable skills, given dealing since 9-10 years old? How did that become apparent?
Well, Tom, I'm still wondering, to tell you the truth. I was reasonably diligent at my work. I turned up on time. I was interested, and I think most importantly, my boss liked me. Of course, that preference didn't. It was sort of slightly confusing because for everyone concerned, because I was actually sent down to be the assistant manager of a sale room that Phillips had in Lisson Grove, which was a sort of junk house clearance side of it, and apart from anything, I was meant to book vans for clearances. And I had no idea whether a two-room flat was half a load or a full load or two loads. I had to clerk the sales, and the books were made up with carbonous copies for right-handers, and I was left-handed. So a combination of dyslexia and everything being the wrong way around, I was always about 15 lots behind. Then I had to sort of balance the books at the end of the day. I think after about 6 months of that, the management thought it was actually safer and cheaper to give me a cataloguing job rather than a management job. And that's how I started cataloguing the paintings for the Lisson Grove sale room. And I just sort of worked my way through the system.
After 8 years with Phillips, you moved to the old master dealership, Ledger Galleries, on Bond Street in 1983. Now, carrying significant weight in the art world, Ledger had previously established galleries in New York, Brussels, Paris and Chicago, so this was not an insignificant name by any means. It's also a huge responsibility for you to take on. What drew you in that direction, and what do you think Ledger had seen in you that saw them bring you in to manage the gallery, coming from an auction background?
Well, I'd had some pretty, a lot of experience at the coalface then, and it's not something I, like everything in my life, I'd sort of fell into it. I was having a casual conversation with David Posnett, who was running the Ledger Galleries at the time, and I asked him if he'd been able to fill a job which I knew he'd been advertising for in a rather sort of ambiguous way, because a friend of mine had applied. And he said, well, how do you know about that job, and why didn't you apply? And that's how it ended up in my sort of vital interview. And it was a fascinating transition from the sale room, where it basically volume was the mantra. One just had to sort of process things coming in and into sales or reject them at the counter to a much more specialized discriminating market, and of course applying a sort of different selling technique. The auction houses claim to potential buyers, oh, you can probably buy this as cheaply as possible with us, and the desire of the merchant is to maximize their profit. And it took a while to get used to this, and also just the process of selling, and it takes a long time to be comfortable with the process, and also to be comfortable with oneself as to how one does it. And the fascination with this particular business is that every single dealer is different, has different ideas, has different approaches, as does every buyer, whether they're museum buyers or private buyers. Each one has a singular approach, and it's and that's particularly fascinating, and keeps one's mind lively. One's got to think on the ground and get it right.
If we were to just to contrast, just to pick up on a point you made a moment ago, the difference between Ledger Galleries and Phillips, and you mentioned volume, of course, and intrinsically two very different business models. I wonder, when you contrast your experience with the auction house and the gallery, was there an opportunity within the gallery to pursue more of that research aspect that you liked?
Yes, it was all about, as it were, getting it right. In the first place, buying the thing that one thought there was a market for. So one had to be discriminating as to, as it were, what one's client base would be interested in. And of course, one can help shift those interests and tastes over a period. But also, it's a matter of dotting the I's and crossing the T's. It is the research and having all the information to hand. We always used to like to, as it were, know as much as we thought we could find before we bought something rather than after it. And I think it still pays to do one's due diligence. And often during the course of the process, one decides, well, maybe I don't like this work as much as I thought I did a week ago, and perhaps one shouldn't buy it. So one goes through a refining process, and part of that is the sort of the thrill of a chase of pertinent information and opinion regarding a particular object, and that I think is a very satisfying process to go through, and of course one's learning every day.
Well, you mentioned something before which was again caught my attention. When you think about what a dealer does at your level, it's almost like you're looking for a market, you're seeing a market perhaps ahead of time, seeing potential value that others may have missed. And this is a theme that's come up in other episodes. And of course, you established a record for a particular work bidding at auction, which I think took the market by surprise. What can you tell us about that, and how significant is that? Has that been to you in being able to see things ahead of time and see value that others have missed and established a value for something?
Well, I've often paid what considered to be sort of crazy prices at auction, or much higher prices at auction for objects that's made record prices. One sort of gut instincts about how special something is, and it's very difficult to to try and analyze it, because the subtleties are so tiny. But when one comes across something which is really special, one knows about it, and I believe that there are always buyers out there who will eventually want something which is particularly special of its own kind. And so I look for the combination of beauty, rarity, and interest, and that goes for the sort of context in which it was made. And I think when one gets all those criteria together at a high level, it's a picture or a drawing or a sculpture that one actually really ought to have, because ultimately I'm only, and my colleagues are only, as good as the best things that we can offer to our clients, and that's not only the proof of the pudding, but it's also the validation for, as it were, sticking one's neck out.
Now, this is interesting because, of course, some 35 years ago, prior to this point now, the conversation we're having, you actually found an old black and white photograph of a watercolour and would go on to spend the next 15 years searching for it without any success. In a twist of fate, with you having stopped looking, not only would it appear, rather play an important role as you struck out on your own. What happened? Tell us about the picture and how it would become important to you.
Oh, well, yes. At Ledger, we used to maintain really very extensive photographic archives by artists. And basically every photograph that we had, every magazine, every sale room catalogue was, cut up, and the images were filed. And one day, going through the 15 boxes of images of watercolours by Thomas Rowlandson, I came across a very old, flimsy black and white photograph of an image which I immediately recognised as of an artist in Wales, and I knew it well from reproductions in books on landscape painting and the picturesque. They always illustrated a colour print of this, and this appeared to be an original drawing. And I couldn't find any trace of it, and I kept on looking everywhere I could, because it obviously had to exist. And after about 10 years, I really gave this up as a bad job. And then I suppose in about sort of 2000, another dealer offered it to me, and named a price, and I sort of bit his hand off, as they say, and bought it, and actually rather intended to keep it for myself, because it was the last step in a slightly romantic search for this particular watercolour. I kept it for about a year or so, and then I really realized that the business needed more money into it to pay the bills, and I sold it to a very good client of mine who thoroughly enjoyed it, and my bank manager thoroughly enjoyed the respite from my account being in the red all the time. And then it was offered back to me by the collector's estate, and I was able to sell it to a really good friend of mine who collects images of artists at work. So it was incredibly satisfying that actually to have had it twice, to have found it in the first place, and for it to end up in a collection which it has, as it were, once again that word context, and I know it's in good hands and will be used to its utmost. It's a really satisfying story, and it makes the thrill of the chase is great, but one actually does have to find a final, once one's got the thing, something which is a satisfactory end.
Mm. I think it's interesting because the picture that you've found there, the story that wraps around it, it's obviously instrumental because it helps you capitalize your business as you've struck out on your own by this point, leaving Ledger, which was merged with Spink after acquisitions made by Christie's. But we're obviously describing a period in time in your career here where there's quite a great deal of change taking place. And a previous conversation we'd had, I found it was quite interesting what your relationship was to change. And it's certainly not something that most people or many of us would describe. But describe your relationship to change and how you feel about it.
One can't go backwards. One can only go forwards. And as I said earlier, I don't necessarily, a lot of career changes haven't been sort of strategized by me, but just as it were, happened. But it became clear to me that at the time that the idea of Spink and Spink Ledger being a sort of department store for works of art across the board wasn't really viable, given the way it was managed, and it was rather unadventurous. Anyway, it came to the point where Christie's, who owned Spink, were wanting to divest themselves of their retail arms, and I made a proposal to buy the picture business, which was rejected after several months of negotiations, thank goodness. And I, as it were, took the leap into starting my own business with a lot of hope and very little funding of my own. I've never had a backer, so with my payoff, I went off on my own and I left Bond Street. I'd already found premises around the corner in Clifford Street, expecting to carry on dealing at the level at which I had been previously, and that was something of a struggle, and the first 8 years were hell, but I eventually got it right, and by and large it's worked and been rather good fun since. It's always a challenge, but that's what keeps on going, and I like change because actually I didn't want to be doing what I was doing. I suppose my slightly competitive nature, and it only comes out here really, is that I want to try and be ahead of the game, and it's interesting to synthesize ideas into something which might be seen to be new or taken from a different angle, and that's fun, and it's challenging. There's no sense in doing what one does well because eventually one finds that actually other people just think it's actually not particularly relevant.
Yeah. You just to go back there, when you were referencing Spink Ledger, talking about you use words like department store and not being adventurous, I'd like to know from where you're sitting, how can a gallery be adventurous in its dealings, in its business? What would you mean by that?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I think it's all about having imagination. Ever since I first been with business, since 75, I've heard dealers, especially older dealers, complaining that there's nothing to buy, there's nothing of quality, and the whole thing is miserable and they don't know why they're doing it. Well, I've never found that. There's always something marvellous around the corner. There's always something interesting to buy. And if one uses one's imagination and just is in touch with what was general thought and culture, I hate to say zeitgeist, one, if one's imaginative, one actually just feels the change and one reacts to it. And if one can react slightly ahead of the game, it's sometimes a good thing. It's certainly always a good thing in terms of challenging oneself. And one's always got to make the best of what one's got, and but I think one can do it in different and interesting ways, and I think one does become less adventurous as one gets older, and I'm very lucky to have two marvelous, much younger colleagues who are helping me fight, who are actually taking the lead and fighting the good fight, as it were.
This is nice because it's segues in quite nicely to, I'd like to fast forward now to around 2011. And you made a very important hire, bringing Johnny Yarker into the business, who was at the time completing his PhD. Now, as you've already referenced and alluded to here, Johnny would, of course, go on to become a director of the gallery and your business partner 7 years after starting with yourself. Now, as someone without comparable qualifications, what are the qualities you see in someone like Johnny, or indeed James Holland Hibbert, for example, who you'd encouraged during your stays at Spink Ledger?
Well, I think it's obviously a knowledge, and we're all gathering that all the time. So knowledge is at a certain level at any given point. It's sort of passion and determination, and a willingness to take risk, albeit calculated risk. And I'd met Johnny a few years before at various sort of conferences and symposia where he'd been either giving papers or participating in some way. And he was so obviously someone who was incredibly bright and engaging and interested in much the area that I'm interested in. And amazing. I suppose most jobs where one's I only speak for our trade, but it's a fairly lonely business, and it's a great comfort to have someone to bounce ideas off. One can't do it necessarily with one's competitors, colleagues, and no one else really understands how it works. So I thought this is the time to move on, and not that I'd ever thought that my little business would have any longevity, but and it's not what I was aiming for, but it seemed to me to be a great opportunity if Johnny would join me to see what we could make of it. And I proposed this idea to him, I have to say, completely off the cuff at a dinner where we were both attending. And after about 6 months of thinking and occasionally talking about it, he decided to throw his lot in with me. And it's been immense fun, it's been immensely challenging, interesting, stimulating, and I think we're doing great things. And Johnny is more than able to finesse in a really sophisticated and with integrity, all the things that I value in terms of scholarship and integrity of getting things right. And he's got a great eye and a great memory, and it's been a life changer for me, and every day is stimulating.
I want to come back to the interesting things you're referring to that you've done with Johnny and your colleagues at the gallery. But you mentioned there the business of art can be a lonely experience. What are you referring to there? Are you describing the many hours that you'll spend researching things, tracking things down? Could you enlighten us?
So tracking things down and research is always stimulating, if sometimes frustrating. No, it's more the one puts an enormous amount of emotional, there's enormous, great emotional investment, and actually very often financial investment in what one's doing. The fact is, 19 out of 20 times one can show the object which one thinks is marvelous and interesting to someone, and they say, no, it's very nice, but not for me, or I don't like it, or I don't get it. And that sort of sense of, I won't go be as dramatic to say rejection, but well, you know, it's difficult when one has so much of oneself riding on these inanimate objects, and it's incredibly comforting and encouraging to have someone to share that with. And you know, two brains are better than one.
It almost sounds like the level and the depth of breadth of research and time and money invested sees you inevitably build up a very deep and personal relationship with the works. So it's not, in some ways, I mean, we could sound quite romantic about this, but when you're putting a work up there for someone to view and potentially buy, there's a piece of you in there as well. That's what it sounds like.
Oh, yes, and I think also the fact is that the ultimate purchaser is also buying a part of one as well. In terms, it's not just the object, it's, I'm not being romantic, but actually it's the intelligence and credibility that one brings to the dialogue and to the object. And that's particularly fascinating, the relationships one forms between objects and with other people, and often the catalyst being a particular thing. And that's incredibly stimulating. I think that getting a piece of something else which is intangible is part of the process. I think my view is that no matter how much one may want something as a potential customer, one is very, very rarely going to buy it from someone one doesn't like. Doesn't mean they have to be your best friend, but there has to be some sort of empathy and mutual respect. Otherwise, the dynamics just don't work. And you know, I perfectly accept there are some people who, I only speak for myself, like me, and some people who don't get me. And the world is a big place, and they go to dealers or buy in ways which suit their psyche, and that's the fascination of sort of human nature.
It's interesting because this what you're touching on here is a characteristic of that makes galleries very unique, and that is that they deal predominantly. There's always a large cohort of well-known clients who they've dealt with for many years. And what you've just described there really sums that up quite nicely, because a dealer, a gallery, is acting as a guide for clients. It's helping them find works over time that they know will appeal to their tastes.
Yes, I think it's incredibly important. Although, as you say, I've pushed for change in the way in what we do and the way we approach certain things. I hope that what one sees and what I've been doing over the years, there's a consistency of taste and a consistency, I hope, of integrity in one's approach to these things. And I think that actually clients or potential clients understand that, and each and every dealer brings, even if they're dealing in exactly the same area, bring a different approach to it. And ultimately, if one is as a collector or as a curator, one's spending what is always relatively a large amount of money wherever one is on the scale, one needs to be happy about the entire transaction. And that also means the people you're dealing with and one's feeling about them, that they're actually doing a good job and doing well by one. And I think that's a mutual appreciation of a sensible, constructive end goes an awful long way, and is one of the most satisfying things that I've got clients who, where I've been dealing with two, sometimes three generations of a family. I think there's mutual responsibility on each side, and it works. But I do it to other people.
Let's just fast forward again now to 2014, and yourself and Johnny would mount the largest commercial exhibition of Gainsborough's landscapes to be held in a century. So no small feat by any means. In addition to numerous important discoveries made, you do have a long-standing personal relationship with Gainsborough's work in particular, and you're a trustee of Gainsborough House. Now, as someone who's been up close to, studied, and dealt in so many of his works, through your eyes, what can you share with us about Gainsborough and his work in particular? What makes it significant and resonate with people to the extent that they do?
Well, Gainsborough is a as you say, a great love of mine. And I specifically refer to his landscapes mostly his landscape drawings, which were more numerous than his oils in that genre. And there's something incredibly lovable about the man and his artistic personality. And he makes everything, tries to make everything look simple. Where in fact, his paintings and drawings are highly complex in terms of their making, and highly sophisticated in what he sort of draws on from his experience to bring to them. And he sort of synthesizes the sort of classical tradition into something which is much more emotionally reactive on his part, and hopefully on the part of the viewers of his works. And they have an emotional energy, and intellectually they throw fascinating light onto the changing philosophical attitudes of the age. And they are, certainly his landscapes and the drawings especially, are pieces of poetry. I've never seen a bad drawing by him. I think he destroyed an awful lot as he went along, because his technique is so strange in the way he builds up the image. I've never seen a bad one. There are good ones, there are fantastic ones, there are truly great ones. But each one has a different emotional quality, and some are, I think, sublime. Over the last 30-odd years, I've been able to handle a large proportion of very, very wonderful drawings by him, and the occasional painting when they come to the market, and they give me great satisfaction. And he's also fascinating in terms of the collectors, as it were. I've discovered over the years that it's a bit like Marmite. People either get Gainsborough or they're left completely befuddled by what this strange artist is trying to do, and it doesn't make any sense. And there's no grey area in between, which is always amuses me, but it is certainly a fact of life. He's an artist who continues to delight and fascinate me, and that's, in a way, all one wants from a work of art.
Mm. When did that delight and that fascination begin for you with Gainsborough in particular? Was that something from when you were much younger, or is that something that developed in later life?
No, I think there's actually not from. I admired the portraits, but I really only came to appreciate the subtlety and the inventiveness of Gainsborough, into some maturity, as it were. And like a lot of people, I didn't quite understand them to begin with. They take a lot of looking at and thinking, because they're very complex things, and it grows on one. And Gainsborough as a man is such an attractive personality anyway, that there grows a sort of fusion between one's liking for the person and one's reaction to the work. So it's it continues and grows. So it's very nice. I don't feel jaded by this particular artist, and so I continue to enjoy the thrill of the chase and owning these things for a while.
Could you expand a little bit on what you've just said there when you refer to Gainsborough having an interesting personality? What do you mean by that?
Well, he was an extremely amiable, gregarious man. His greatest love was music. He played the viola da gamba, which is sort of cello, and he knew his own mind, and he was a generous friend and someone who was sensitive and not particularly and he was also a rebel. You know, he fell out with the Royal Academy because they wouldn't hang, he was a Royal Academician, but they wouldn't hang pictures in the way he wanted them to, and eventually fell out and actually exhibited his pictures at his house and studio rather than the Royal Academy. He is independent. He knew what moved him, and he sort of, and he follows it. I mean, he's almost obsessive in painting and drawing a certain type of landscape, which he almost draws the same landscape for 40 years, constantly refining it. And they're landscapes of the imagination, of emotion, very often based on a sort of classic or classical formula, but he plays around with each and every work, and I think I find this, as it were, this spirit, this desire to sort of push on, try new things, experiment, terribly endearing.
Johnny was quoted as having said, "We operate in an apparently narrow field, but Lowell has an amazing ability to reinvent what we do." What is he referring to here in relation to you reinventing things?
Oh, I'm quite happy to, and as Johnny, go out on a limb, try something new, even if it doesn't work. 3 or 4 years ago, I held put on an exhibition with a very old friend of mine who deals in Chinese works of art. Of drawings by contemporary Chinese draftsmen and 18th and early 19th century British drawings. It was an interesting exercise. So, you know, commercially, it was a disaster, but it was a hell of a lot of fun. We produced a rather beautiful catalogue. We showed it in New York, where it actually looked better than it did in London, and sold a few things. But it was just interesting to do. And I think we're always happy to think about something new, even if we reject it after consideration. We don't always, you know, our decisions are not always right. We make more good decisions than bad decisions, but. We both have a desire to think about different directions, or even for things that we normally are interested in handle. Is there a different angle which one should look at this from? And is it, you know, where does the interest, or what connections can one make with, as it were, taste and interests now? Is no good taking the approach that one did even 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago. The world moves on, and quite frankly, if it's not challenging oneself, the entire sort of process becomes rather dull. So I'm always willing to try something new. Johnny is full of brilliant ideas, and he comes from a much younger and academic has serious academic training, so he's in touch with a lot of the interests of people who are not of my generation, I think it's very interesting to take what we're doing into different directions, as long as we maintain the integrity of what we do, and I think that consistency of taste, which is slightly indefinable, but it's something that we're aware of, that things have to be special.
When you cast your mind back to being 9 or 10, and your grandmother awoke in you, in some respects, that passion for art, antiques, and sculpture, what do you think she'd have to say about where you are today and all that's unfolded?
Well, undoubtedly she'd be proud. I don't know why she should be, but you know, she'd be fascinated. Actually, she's someone who was fascinated by the workings of how things happened, and she'd be particularly fascinated by the day-to-day mechanics of what we do and how we achieve it. I think she would have been a thorough supporter of going it alone and following something with passion and enthusiasm.
With the benefit of experience, if you could go back and give your younger self embarking on the journey at the beginning, what would it be?
It would be, I think, have the courage of one's convictions. It's okay to look stupid or to voice opinions that one might think in retrospect, or other people might think are stupid. I think one's strong reactions are often the best for one. I think I always think that everyone is straightforward, and basically life is fairly good if one can keep one's bank manager happy and at the same time as delighting one's the few clients or the few people who actually buy things from one. And I think it is really have the strength of one's convictions, and one can make something of it.
Thank you for listening. You can follow and subscribe to The Bigger Picture wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about this episode or to reach out to us directly, please visit arcata.com.